From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from NPR's election headquarters in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. And the candidates have voted both in New York State, where they live. Voters around the country are at the polls as we speak.
And Jeremy, we've heard a lot this season about Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump's paths to the White House. Well, they are reaching the end of that journey. Trump's path is said to be paved through the Midwest. He's made a last-minute push for Michigan, a state that hasn't gone Republican since 1988. He held the last rally of his campaign in that state in Grand Rapids last night. Hillary Clinton, along with Bill Clinton and President and Mrs. Obama, were in Philadelphia last night. The Democrats trying to hold on what's called the Blue Wall, states here in New England or in California that traditionally vote Democratic. Joining us now, NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hi there, guys.
This is like your Christmas.
So, you know, this is great. It's like, you know, we get rid of the 15 months or 18 months of completely not knowing anything, actually, but having lots of thoughts about it. So now we get to actually do real data. So I get super excited on Election Day.
Oh, well, and we love that about you. So start with Michigan, the Mitt up there on the Great Lakes. Clinton and President Obama visited the state over the past few days. This real push on the part of Republicans. What's going to happen there? What's happening there?
Well, in part, it's because Hillary Clinton has this blue wall of Democratic-leaning states toward her that put her over 270 electoral votes needed to be president, you know, without winning any of those toss-up states. She could lose Florida, Ohio, Iowa, North Carolina, even New Hampshire at this point, because I put Nevada now in the lean Democratic column, mm-hmm. given early vote. So the point is, if Donald Trump wins all of those toss-ups and those lean states toward him, he needs one more. He needs a big state. And Michigan undoubtedly has always been somewhat close. Both campaigns will acknowledge privately that that Clinton has the advantage and that she's ahead, but by a much narrower margin than President Obama was. Remember, he won the state twice by double digits. Democrats believe if they can get their voters out, black voters in particular, they win.
When it comes to the timeline tonight, it's always funny every election day. The two states that report their results first are two states that get almost no attention in the campaign. Kentucky and Indiana will be out first because their polls close earlier than the other states. But what are you going to be watching for tonight in terms of the timeline, Domenico?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say that those are completely, you know, states we should blow off either, because Indiana has a very key Senate race. And the presidential result will tell us something about how the rest of the country is going. South Carolina also polls have been fairly close there because of the high number of black voters. But, you know, of course, Republicans expected to win also close at 7 o'clock. And Virginia closes at 7 o'clock as well. 7:30, I think, is the key. You've got North Carolina, huge state that Democrats, that the Clinton campaign calls the roadblock state. They believe that Donald Trump does not have a path to the presidency if he loses North Carolina. That closes at 7:30. Ohio's also at 7:30. And then at 8 o'clock, we've got a slew of states, 17 more, 188 electoral votes. By the time polls close at 8 o'clock, half the country would have voted already, and the votes will just be counted. I wouldn't expect, though, a lot of these races to be called at poll close time, the ones that we expect to be close, because I do think you're going to see what Hillary Clinton has had is this broad, shallow, consistent lead. But I think that means that a lot of states are going to be within 5 points, and you're not going to know for a while.
And remember, pay attention to Domenico and the team at NPR tonight. Don't pay too much attention to these early polling systems that are coming out now, because, for instance, a lot of young people don't vote till nighttime, so you might be getting wrong information. But Domenico, I'm going to pull at just one thread here. You mentioned African Americans. Sure. What about Latinos? Big surge. Yeah.
I think Latinos is the most underreported story of this election because a lot of reporters don't speak Spanish. They don't understand or watch Univision and you know, be able to understand the kind of Spanish language kitchen table conversations that are going on. But anecdotally, when we've been on the ground out there and now it's showing up in the metrics, Latinos really feel under siege in this election, starting with Donald Trump's announcement speech calling immigrants in the U.S. illegally rapists who are bringing crime. And they don't feel that about themselves. They feel like they're hardworking people who are just trying to make it economically in the way a lot of other immigrant groups emigrated to the United States. So they feel really under siege. They feel like they need to get out and vote because they don't understand what the threat potentially could be if Donald Trump wins.
Yeah. Well, we will keep an eye on all the many threads. He will weave them together tonight. That's NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
And now that we've come to the end of this long campaign, we want to take a minute now to look back at some of the best reporting that came out of it with NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm doing well, and I feel like David Farenthold of The Washington Post, who's been reporting on Trump's charitable contributions or lack thereof, would have to make anyone's list.
I think it's at the top. I think it was spectacular on two levels. It was really bird-dogging one way of holding Trump accountable for his public statements and his past record of statements. The image that he created of himself as this sort of gruff, brash-talking philanthropist billionaire with a heart of gold who quietly did a lot of good. And he really tried to track down with any number of charities, particularly initially for veterans groups, any evidence showing that Trump had done what he had said he had done, and found scant evidence. The other thing that was tremendous about what Farenthold did was he did it in public. He kept posting these lists of veterans groups that he had reached out to. He encouraged other people to make suggestions when the Trump campaign folks and the Trump organization folks weren't really being responsive to him. He posted publicly to allow just ordinary citizens who might know of something to respond, to allow people from those organizations to respond and know what his questions were, and also to show his homework in public. I thought it was a tremendous display of accountability journalism.
What else stands out to you in the reporting on this campaign?
You know, there were some things along the way that I think were signposts that were meaningful and that people may not have recognized at the time. If you think over a year ago, Evan Osnos of The New Yorker wrote a piece where he ended up kind of by accident doing a piece about the way in which Trump's rhetoric had tapped into what some call the alt-right, but really was a form of white nationalist and racist rhetoric and sympathies. And by going to certain kinds of gatherings and groups meetings, he realized that Trump had tapped into this kind of seemingly submerged belief system and rhetoric that was going to form part of Trump's appeal to certain voters. And that really proved over the course of the campaign, but it was written back in, you know, late summer of 2015. I thought that was remarkable work. Similarly, there are folks, some of the chroniclers of Trump over the years emerged, Wayne Barrett, David K. Johnson, and certainly others, to really try to provide some context for all of those business dealings Trump had, about the way in which he really was a brand at times more than a business in and of itself. You know, you've got to also think of the piece that Jane Mayer did in The New Yorker talking to Trump's ghostwriter, which I originally thought was sort of a cute and frivolous way of looking at Trump. And the more you read it, the more it was sort of like a horror story talking about him. I felt that the reporting on Hillary Clinton was less imaginative, more kind of by the books. But then again, Clinton herself is a known quantity. She's been pored over by the press and, for that matter, by certain Republican-led congressional investigative committees for basically the last 2.5 decades. And I thought that stood out less. One other thing I'd say is that a lot of the embeds, particularly the younger reporters who've been tracking the campaign for the trail, really used social media wonderfully to capture the essence of what it was like to be there, at times to throw a little shade and provide more voice, which is a little controversial among some of our perhaps more veteran colleagues, but nonetheless giving you a texture of what it was like to not only cover the campaign, to be with the campaigns, but also at times to deal with the campaigns. And I thought that was important, too.
I just want to point out one thing, David, which is a lot of the reporting that you have talked about as being very good reporting has been in print publications at a time when we are still seeing kind of a decline in print journalism, layoffs happening still, they're losing revenue. What does that say to you, that they're still doing such important reporting, even though they're dealing with fewer resources?
Sure. This is one of the fundamental truths that has not changed, even as we've seen so much sweeping changes in the media landscape, which is that it is the traditional legacy newspapers, even as they become more digitized outfits, that provide the greatest part of the horsepower that propels journalism forward. These are the engines that serve to inspire so much coverage on cable news, on the news wires, all of the kinds of takes from places like Vox and other sites that tend to analyze rather than simply doing original reporting. you know, newspapers are a vital part of how democracy functions and have been for decades and continue to be so, even as, you know, we're not talking about modest declines here. We're talking about really perilous drops in advertising seen by really important companies, the parent companies, the New York Times, of the Wall Street Journal, of Gannett, which owns USA Today, which did a fantastic piece analyzing the 3,500 lawsuits that Trump and his businesses have been embroiled in. All of these major important owners of powerful papers, both national and regional, has suffered sweeping losses in terms of how much revenue they derive from advertising. They are more and more dependent upon subscribers. And in a sense, they're really reverting to kind of a public radio way of saying things. Some of these newspapers call their subscribers members, as though they're public radio donors for local stations, because they're saying you have to personally support the kinds of journalism that emerges from what we do. We can no longer rely on advertisers to do so indirectly simply to get your eyeballs.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thanks so much.
You bet.
And there has also been criticism that the media didn't take Trump seriously enough early on and that the media didn't take Bernie Sanders seriously. What are your thoughts on good and bad media coverage of the campaign? You can weigh in at our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/hereandnowradio or at our website, hereandnow.org.
It's Here and Now. So the Republicans started out with 17 candidates, the Democrats with 11, including performance artist Vermin Supreme. Now it's down to 2. We followed them on our election road trip from the beginning to this bitter end. Today, a review, starting with the Iowa caucuses, where we met the Iowa State Pep Band. Hit it!
This is like Disneyland for you.
Oh, it is. It is my World Series. It is my World Cup. It is my Super Bowl. It is everything.
When I say madam, you say president. Madam!
President!
Madam!
The perception is when you come to Iowa, it's corn and a bunch of white people. New Iowans can learn how to caucus. So take advantage of this.
That last sound was from a forum to teach new African-American voters the square dance that is an Iowa caucus. In Ames, we went door-knocking on a freezing afternoon with a Clinton volunteer.
Hey, are you Addie?
Yeah.
Addie, hi, I'm Cindy Passion. I am just here to find out if you know where to go to caucus.
I don't.
Okay.
I was actually, is it
That's
at the
why
high
I'm here.
School this year or no?
It's at Northwood.
Oh, okay.
You know what Northwood is?
Yeah.
Then on to the New Hampshire primaries, a high-tech factory hoping a new president would retrain workers. Another band, the Manchester Memorial High School Jazz Band.
It's a wide open field on both sides of the aisle, and it's been exciting to watch. I'll be okay when people leave tomorrow, though, and go home.
Including me.
Absolutely.
You gonna say something? I really love the political season. I'm in love with the New Hampshire politics, and I'm in love with the New Hampshire primary. But I sure wish more people would come to the farm.
I really was thinking about you this year. Like, what does Tony think?
For the first time in my life, I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Ta-da! That last voter who wasn't sure, here and now's longtime friend and the staunch Republican, Tony Halla of the Canterbury Country Store. But other voters were absolutely convinced. Dan Kavanaugh was for Marco Rubio for many reasons.
I mean, you can start with the national debt. You can start with the fact that, labor participation rate is the worst that it's been since the 1970s. I mean, we're in some perilous times.
My name's Andrew Grosvenor. I'm feeling the burn this time. No, I'm excited. I can't wait to see what happens today.
Bernie was rising, and there were signs in New Hampshire of the Trump wave, literally, one on Joel Crossman's front yard in Loudoun, New Hampshire.
It's 4x8.
4x8.
Yeah.
Obviously, you wanted to make a statement, so what was the statement you're making?
Well, I'm really tired of politicians, all right? And Trump's not a politician. And I think this past administration has done more damage to this country than, any generations in the past.
How so? I mean, when you look at the economy while you're thinking, the unemployment rate has dropped. We've been huge recovery from that.
No, they're telling you the unemployment rate has dropped. It really hasn't dropped. It's actually increased. There's a lot of people out of work. I'm out of work myself.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah. I haven't gotten visited by Donald yet, but you notice I say yet.
You hope you do.
Yeah. Maybe he'll give me a job.
On to Michigan. One stop, the Shatila Cafe in Dearborn, owned by Lebanese Americans. We met Osama Siblani, who fled Lebanon's civil war in the 1970s and publishes the Arab American News. At this point in the race, the candidate field is narrowing. The rhetoric is escalating.
It's very sad to see the kind of rhetoric that we have been hearing from the Republicans, at least.
Banning Muslims from entering the country, building a wall, is that...
It's worse than that. They're speaking about the sizes of their hands and their genitals. You know, I mean, just we are talking right now, dirty.
And then, still with us? I know this is exhausting. On to New York in April. Bernie Sanders is surging. We met with Lisa Fleith at a packed Sanders headquarters in Brooklyn.
As folks are made aware of who Bernie is and what he stands for, they join in on the campaign. And we have had people seeking us out, saying, what can I do to help? What can I do? I speak Creole. I speak Mandarin. I speak Cantonese. I have a salsa club. They're all here wanting to do what they can.
Over in Brooklyn Heights, it's quieter at Clinton headquarters, but supporters like Annabelle Ivor are working the phones.
I'm gay. I'm Hispanic. I'm a cancer survivor. I'm also at one point I was a high school dropout. I now have a great education. I've worked really hard. And she inspires me because I see her working really hard. She's been at this since the 1980s.
And who can forget our late-night visit at the Friars Club with longtime New York Daily News columnist Linda Stassi. She's been a friend of Donald Trump's and covered him for years.
I think that he knows how to win, and he looked at the field and he said, these are the guys who are not being talked to. These are the disenfranchised blue-collar workers who have this secret racism behind them, and I'm going to hit them. And now he's become the monster that he created.
But Linda, do you ever think about how much you, and not just you, other reporters here in New York, might have helped create him?
We did not create him. We put him on steroids. Nobody can create Donald.
All the usual no's, no eating, no drinking, no smoking, no touching, no cameras inside, no photography of any type.
Out on Long Island we go, to the summer home of Teddy Roosevelt in Sagamore Hill, where Professor Gerald Benjamin was thinking about the election of 1912, when Teddy Roosevelt broke from the Republican Party and formed the Bull Moose Party after he was not chosen as the nominee.
And the end of the day, Woodrow Wilson became president. The Democrat became president. And I think that we're observing the potential of a similar seismic shift and split in the Republican Party. And the consequence might well be the election of a Democrat president, and there'll be, I'm not a soothsayer, but there'll be...
History will flow.
History will change.
Wait, we're almost out of time, and we haven't gotten to the conventions yet. First to the RNC in Cleveland. Yes, protesters outside, but also lots of support for the party's nominee.
I'm not a politician. I'm a business owner. I believe it or not, I sell Tupperware. And I've also been a truck driver. And this country needs to be run like a business instead of the political cesspool that it is.
I am 12 years old, and I am the producer of my dad's show, the Capitol Hill Show. We might have Pence, so...
He's a good producer.
And as we see the moral decay of our nation, the political and economic corruption, as we see... the racial division that we've had in our country, we see the political unrest this election season, it causes some concern.
My country, 'tis of thee.
What was true everywhere we went on our road trip, there were Americans struggling, like Clevelanders Juan Rivera and Cynthia Cruz. Cynthia, holding their daughter, surprised us with the news that in addition to the eviction we were there to talk about, she'd lost a son in a previous violent relationship.
One day, he came, picked up a bike,
and threw it at me. So
it hit your son. It hit your son.
Yeah. So he died. It's been rough. I just sometimes I tell him, like, I'm here because of her and my kids. Because sometimes, you know, you think, okay, I'm going to come suicide. Should I do it? Should I not? I had to go to the mental home for a whole year.
Cynthia's words stay with us. Before we left Cleveland, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where we thought how music often tells the stories of everyday Americans. She will always carry on. Then on to Philadelphia and the Democratic National Convention.
Good morning, welcome to Philly.
Hot pepper with the sweet pepper, with some pickles.
Cold waters, ice cold waters.
Superdelegates.
Again, outside the hall, the debates played out in real life. We went uptown to the gun range where we met Maj Touré. His slogan, Black Guns Matter. He felt young blacks should be educated about guns for safety and protection, which surprises a lot of people.
Well, what I can say to the American people from whatever background you are is, exercise your Second Amendment rights. Look into it. Be open-minded, be objective, and learn, you know, because, you know, a lot of people say, you know, well, the Republicans have backed X, Y, and Z, and even that part is flawed. You know, Dr. King was a staunch, nonviolent person, but he was a Republican. I'm a Republican.
How do you feel about Donald Trump, the candidate?
I don't think about Donald Trump for candidate. I don't. I think about my community.
So, our road trip comes to a close. We think of Arthur Green of Philadelphia. We talked to him about gentrification and the trick of improving neighborhoods without forcing out the people who've long lived there. His words seem appropriate for today.
But when it comes down to change, everything changes. Nothing stays the same. As beautiful as you are right now, all right? There was a time you were more vibrant. Then we get older and we change. I'm not going to have a 28-inch waist anymore, okay? But everything changes. But it's your attitude that needs to change, too.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Not all ingredients are created equal. Blue Apron sources fresh, high-quality ingredients and sends them right to your home in pre-measured packages. You get easy-to-follow recipes so you can have a meal ready in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Tesla has announced that next year it is no longer going to offer free use of its fast charging stations for people who own Teslas. There are more than 700 of these stations around the world. They're often located at highway rest stops. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal joins us from New York with more on this. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jeremy.
And these changes don't affect anyone who has a Tesla or who buys one before January 1st. But what is Tesla's rationale for no longer offering free access to these fast charging stations?
What's their rationale? Well, Wired put it very well. They said that some Tesla owners have treated the free lunch more like an all-you-can-eat buffet. So people are going and camping out and filling up, when really the whole point of this, according to Elon Musk, is that people should just be going there for daily, you know, for quick fill-ups between cities, not for their daily charging. And as a result, there's been congestion at the stations. And also they're looking ahead and they've got projections for a lot more people buying Tesla vehicles. And so they see these charging stations becoming increasingly crowded.
And these charging stations aren't the only places where you can charge. Obviously, yes, as you say, you can fill up at home. But what is the difference in terms of speed between using these fast charging stations and doing it yourself?
There's a really big difference. At home, it's going to take you about 8 hours to fully recharge a battery that's completely used up. At a supercharger, it's going to take less than an hour to do that.
Wow.
And so with these supercharged stations, you can be there for half an hour and you can really top off and be back on the road in a half hour pretty quickly.
So in the new world, how much is it going to cost to do that with the fast chargers?
Well, Tesla's not revealing how much it's going to cost. What they're offering is a 1,000 kilowatt hour limit and per year. So and after that, they'll charge a small fee. They said it'll be cheaper than gas. How far does 1,000 kilowatts get you? Well, you know, that tends to vary, but it's probably about 1,000 miles. So you get about 1,000 miles free. And, you know, the value in gasoline, that's about $100 in gasoline cost.
Other automakers, including General Motors and BMW, also have electric cars. Do they have these kind of stations, or how do they handle this situation?
No, no. Most of these other sellers of electric cars, including GM, BMW, and others, they're letting buyers figure it out using home charging stations or public charging stations, independent power providers. And so a lot of these places you can get subscriptions that will charge either by the hour. Some of them are all you can eat, but it really varies what the charges are and also depends on where you live, what's available to you.
Put this in the context of Tesla more broadly. They are going to buy a German company that develops systems for making batteries. They're also in the process of acquiring the solar panel maker SolarCity. What's the larger story, Jason, about what's happening with Tesla?
Well, the larger story is that this is a company that's preparing for mammoth growth. They're hoping to boost production to 500,000 cars a year by 2018. And it already says it has 373,000 reservations for its Model 3. Also, for context, the company produced about 50,000 cars last year. So they're ramping up from 50,000 to 500,000 by 2018.
Wow.
Major growth. But, and they're also now reporting profits, which is pretty exciting to them and their shareholders.
Well, I should hope so, given the cost of a Tesla. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Oh, democracy. Today we are all inseparable cities with our arms about each other's necks. A little Walt Whitman there, Leaves of Grass. More to come. But first, let's hear from voters, starting with a poll worker in New Hampshire.
I'm Gloria Pilot, a moderator at Ward 9 in Manchester, New Hampshire. There's a wonderful turnout, continuously busy. Busy's good. It's a good sign that people are taking interest and taking ownership of our country is the way that I look at it. So we're very happy and we're all working together. That's the important thing. We all have to work together. And there is no rigging and there is no fraud. I can guarantee you, you're welcome to come down and watch.
I'm Jeff Murphy from Watertown, Massachusetts. I'm excited that I think some of the more troubling aspects of this year's election have people talking about politics in a way that maybe they weren't before. And I'm glad to see, you know, a giant line here at my local polling station.
Now to Phoenix, Arizona, where Judy Moore voted this morning.
I voted for Donald Trump. I think the country needs a change. He's a great businessman, and I think he'll do the best job.
And Robert Hartman voted for Hillary Clinton.
She promises to take care of the older people more carefully. And I think she just has a better view of where the United States is going.
And in Chicago, Philippe Bascunyan voted for the Green Party.
The economy is still not good for most people. Jobs have come back, but they're not good jobs. I'm in college. I am facing, you know, not having any, like, real work after I graduate, and I'm still going to have, like, massive amounts of debt. That's not going away.
And in North Carolina, Ashraf Malik spoke for many when he said he can't wait till it's over.
It was disgraceful for all of us Americans that it was so debasing and demeaning. So I'm totally, it was like a torture. And I'm just praying that this thing gets over and we never have an ugly campaign like this again.
The thoughts of voters from around the country today. It was a nasty race. It split the Republican Party, many voting for the Democrat because they couldn't stomach the Republican. I'm referring, of course, to the election of 1884, personal favorite, New York Governor Grover Cleveland, the Democrat called Grover the Good for his good deeds, running against the Republican James Blaine, a former corrupt U.S. Senator from Maine, accused of selling his influence in Congress to business interests. But then, October surprise, Cleveland was accused of fathering a child out of wedlock. He decided the best path was to own up to that, even though Blaine's supporters sang the lyrics, "Ma, ma, where's my pa? Gone to the White House, ha, ha, ha." But the Republicans, who couldn't stomach Blaine's corruption and maybe the fact that he was Catholic, bolted. They called themselves the Mugwumps and sided with the Democrats. Cleveland won by less than 1% of the vote. Well, the great American poet Walt Whitman watched it all unfold and then wrote the great poem Election Day, November 1884. The current great American poet, Robert Pinsky, is here with some thoughts. He's the former poet laureate, creative writing teacher at Boston University. Robert Pinsky, welcome back to Here and Now.
Pleasure to be here, Robin.
And, you know, we want to hear you read this poem, but first, this time in history. We had historian Heather Cox Richardson on, and she pointed to this race as the one that is somewhat like the moment we're in now with the Republican Party maybe splitting at the seams.
There's that, and there's also the word ugly or unpleasant. I mean, people were calling one another very bad names and on the one hand accused of sexual misconduct and on the other hand accused of, apparently with a lot of evidence, of being a crook.
Yeah.
And the cartoons, it's easy these days to Google into this territory. They were really, really nasty to one another, as their supporters were. And you said Cleveland be blamed by less than 1%. New York was the pivotal state. Tammany Hall was against him. It was 0.1% that he carried New York.
A squeaker. Well, and at this point in his life, Walt Whitman, we understand, was completely disenchanted by politics.
Apparently, and in the poem, it's interesting. The poem, he doesn't say this is our sacred ritual or this is our glorious thing. He just says it's very powerful and or good or ill humanity.
We're going to hear the poem, but talk a little more about what you see in the overall language. First of all, he calls the election day our choosing day. I love that.
Yeah, choosing day, and he says it's not the chosen.
Right.
Which is like a lot of people nowadays disavow their candidates. It's not the chosen, it's the choosing. And he compares it to a snowstorm or to Yosemite or Yellowstone's geyser loops. He says it's powerful. And I almost feel he's talking himself into approving of the election.
Right. And this is not Hearts and Flowers. This is not sentimental.
Definitely not. It's not sweet or sunny. He's implying, I think he's saying to himself, it's a lot better than war.
Yeah. It's a better choice than other countries. Let's listen to Robert Pinsky reading Walt Whitman's Election Day, 1884.
Election Day, November 1884. If I should need to name, O Western world, your powerfulest scene and show, 'twould not be you, Niagara, nor you, ye limitless prairies, nor your huge rifts of canyons, Colorado, nor you, Yosemite, nor Yellowstone, with all its spasmic geyser loops ascending to the skies, appearing and disappearing, nor Oregon's white cones, nor Huron's belt of mighty lakes, nor Mississippi's stream. This seething hemisphere's humanity, as now I'd name, the still small voice vibrating America's choosing day. The heart of it not in the chosen, the act itself the main, the quadrennial choosing. The stretch of north and south aroused, seaboard and inland, Texas to Maine, the prairie states, Vermont, Virginia, California. The final ballot shower from east to west. The paradox and conflict, the countless snowflakes falling. A swordless conflict, yet more than all Rome's wars of old or modern Napoleon's, the peaceful choice of all, or good or ill humanity, welcoming the darker odds, the dross, foams and ferments the wine. It serves to purify. While the heart pants, life glows. These stormy gusts and winds waft precious ships, swelled Washington's, Jefferson's, Lincoln's sails.
I feel a little tear. I feel a little tear.
And he goes to the history. He says it's kind of messy and it's dark, good or ill humanity, the darker odds, the dross, these stormy gusts and winds. And he appeals to the past. He just names the three heroes.
Lincoln, first among them for Walt Whitman.
Yes.
Yeah. But what else is here? He's making elections. We're warriors when we vote, the way he describes it.
Mm-hmm. And we're powerful, even though darker ill humanity, it's the power of it. It's like looking at Niagara Falls.
Yeah.
And it's the scale of it. Until the very end, it's really just about the scale of it and the fact that it's, though like war, it's not war. And then the last two words in the poem are Lincoln's sails.
Yeah.
As you say, he takes his hero and says, well, this looks like a mess now. I'm not going to get enthusiastic about Grover Cleveland or James Blaine, but this is a very impressive wind, and it is what brought us Abraham Lincoln.
Yes, the wind that counts.
Yeah.
And as they sail with that wind at their backs. And just before that, he says, hey, there's foam and there's ferment.
Yes.
You know, this troubled seas, yeah, and geysers and things. But it serves to purify.
Well, the heart pants, life glows.
Yeah.
So it's it has that measure of hope that all this mess is like something fermenting. And it has brought us good things in the past.
And one can hope.
Yeah. Yeah.
Robert Pinsky, former U.S. Poet Laureate who teaches creative writing at Boston University. His latest book of poems is At the Foundling Hospital. We'll post this magnificent Walt Whitman piece, Election Day 1884, at hereandnow.org. Robert, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Same here.
Now go vote.
Delhi, India, has been blanketed by toxic smog for more than a week. The government has halted construction and closed schools, and it has announced new steps to try to bring down air pollution levels. Beijing, China, is a city that knows more about smog than almost any other, but the Chinese government has been taking steps to reduce smog. And joining us now is Kevin Mo, who is the managing director of the Paulson Institute Representative Office in Beijing, where he's in charge of sustainable urbanization. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, it was just a couple weeks ago that Beijing issued a yellow alert for air pollution. That's the third highest warning level. How bad has it been this year in Beijing?
Well, it's kind of up and down. And in general, the air quality is improving, but still has a long way to go.
Well, it's improving in part probably because of some of the new environmental regulations that the government has adopted in order to cut down on pollution. What are some of the things that the Chinese have done here?
Yeah, there are several ways they're doing. Like in 2013, China published a action plan for air pollution prevention and control, which set out ambitious PM 2.5 reduction targets for key regions. For example, for Beijing, the 2017 target, which is next year, is for PM 2.5 level, has to be like dropped like 30% below 2012 levels. And in 2014, China revised its environmental protection law, which strengthened the authority of environmental protection agencies, required key emitters to disclose emissions data and increase penalties for violation. And most recently, they changed another regulation because, you know, usually local officials in China are appointed. So usually they stay in one city for 4 to 5 years and then appointed to another cities. In the previous cases, they are not responsible for bad policies that causes environmental pollutions. But now officials are held accountable lifetime for or policies that worsens environment.
And by the way, when you mention PM 2.5, what you're talking about is particles less than 2.5 micrometers in diameter, which pose the greatest health risks in terms of pollution. Beijing also wants to close about 2,500 highly polluting factories. Has it made progress in doing that?
Oh, yes. Beijing has made a lot of progress in that. Actually, they have moved out almost all high energy consuming and high polluting industries out of the cities. But the cities around Beijing are still having a lot of heavy industries of all these polluting plants, then that still causes serious air pollution in Beijing.
What about coal and how much coal consumption there is in China and how that affects pollution in Beijing?
Well, that's a very good question. China's coal use has actually flattened somewhat And there is a considerable debate about the future directions of the coal industry and when coal consumption will peak. Some studies already said China's coal use has already peaked. It appeared that the slower economic growth and a shift away from heavy industry actually helped cut coal use. So right now, the average annual air pollution levels in China's largest cities have fallen significantly from 2 years ago, dropping about 10 to 15%. However, pollution in China's cities is still at dangerous levels, causing, according to some studies, like around 1 million premature deaths per year.
So, Kevin, we're talking to you from Beijing, but this week, Delhi, India, is the place dealing with the worst kind of smog. What would your advice be to the people in Delhi to deal with this smog in the way that perhaps Beijing has?
Well, there are a lot of measures can be taken, but first of all, I would say the main source for air pollution is really the heavy industries. I mean, you have to think about economic transition from those polluted industries to clean technology. That's one thing. Another thing is you probably want to reduce the coal use and also think about protect yourself, which means, for the general public, you have to check the air pollution as often as you check weather forecast. That has become a habit for Beijing residents.
That's Kevin Mo, who is managing director of the Paulson Institute Representative Office in Beijing, in charge of sustainable urbanization. Kevin, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
And whether it is clear or smoggy, we hope you're voting or already have. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson at the Washington headquarters at NPR today for Election Day.
And you'll be there tomorrow. Big day. I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.